Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Carrie Curtis, Chair of the Commonwealth Club of California's Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum and a member of the club's Board of Governors and your moderator for tonight's program. Tonight, we're going to attempt to clear up some of the many misconceptions about offshore oil drilling. Our panelists will outline both the short-term and long-term advantages and disadvantages of drilling offshore. Most of the country agrees that dependence on foreign oil has placed our national security in jeopardy. Advocates on both ends of the political spectrum agree that the United States must move towards energy independence and must do so quickly. Even though offshore oil drilling was a major election issue, much remains unclear about the effects that drilling will have on businesses, consumers, and the environment. So please welcome our panel of experts as we delve deeper into this discussion. Joe Sparano, who is on the far end there, has been president of the Western States Petroleum Association for the last 5 years, following positions with Tesoro Petroleum, Pacific Refining, and other oil companies. Joe's degree in chemical engineering is from Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey, right off the New Jersey Turnpike. Michael Bruhn, who is to my immediate left, has been with Rainforest Action Network since 1998 and is now executive director of that organization. He has led efforts to work with companies like Home Depot to stop utilizing wood from old-growth forests, a very successful initiative. Michael is author of Coming Clean, Breaking America's Addiction to Oil and Coal. His degree in finance is from Westchester University. And when I asked him what a finance guy was doing hugging trees, he had no answer for me. Randall Luthy has been director of the Minerals Management Service of the U.S. Government Department of the Interior since last year, after a long career in public service in Wyoming as a state representative, Speaker of the House of Representatives in Wyoming, and in Washington, D.C. Mr. Luthy is a rancher, attorney, and public servant with bachelor's and law degrees from the University of Wyoming. Go Cowboys.
Thank you. They need all the help they can get.
Didn't they beat somebody really good last week?
Tennessee, I believe.
They did. They won. Peter Schwartz is our final panelist. He is a chairman of the Global Business Network and author of The Art of the Long View, a book used in many business schools for strategic planning. In fact, my students at Golden Gate University have used that book. Peter's degree in aeronautical engineering is from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, not that far from Stevens. He developed his unique approach to scenario planning while at Stanford Research Institute, now called SRI, and later worked for Royal Dutch Shell in London before co-founding the Global Business Network. So let's begin our questions with a question for Joe Sparano, who is with the Western States Petroleum Association. A two-part question, Joe. What are the short and long-term benefits of drilling, and how long, once we get started on that process, how long will we have to wait for the supplies to start coming?
Okay, thank you, Carrie. Just frame the background a little bit. This country today still imports from foreign sources 65% of every drop of crude oil and product we use every single day. That is not energy security and nowhere near energy independence. There are ways to address that. Drilling for oil on and offshore in places where we haven't been allowed to do that for many years is just part of the puzzle, part of solving the problem. We also need to conserve the energy we use. We need to use it more wisely and more efficiently. And we need to really invest a lot of money and time and effort into alternative and renewable fuels. That said, there is still the issue of access and getting to resources that are offshore. And I think Randall will be covering some of the information about the quantity of oil that's out there. It's a lot, oil and gas on and offshore. But in order to bring oil to market from offshore, for example, off the Pacific coast, California offshore, there are 27 platforms already drilling in federal waters. They've been there for many, many years. And although there has been a moratorium on any new drilling, they're producing over 100,000 barrels of oil a day. If we were allowed to access more oil offshore California from those platforms, we already have the infrastructure in place. We have pipelines to shore. We have facilities on shore to handle the oil and any gas that needs to be removed. And with new technology, we have much, much, much better safe operations. We know how to and have performed safely and with environmental sensitivity for many, many years. And we know how to bring oil ashore safely and smartly. And with technology, we now have the ability to drill 6 or 7 miles directionally from the site of the platform. And according to the MMS and U.S. Geologic Survey information that we have, there's over 10 billion barrels of oil offshore Pacific, and most of it is between 24 miles and shore. So there's great opportunity with platforms that sit 10, 11, 12 miles offshore now to get at that oil. How long would it take? Well, it depends, as in most cases. If we were able to access and use the facilities we have, and if we were able to get permits quickly, and if there was very little or no opposition, it's conceivable, according to many experts, that we could bring that oil to market in 2 or 3 years. Very possible, because everyone knows the geology out there. We've been drilling and continue to produce. That's the low end in terms of number of years. If you go into an area, say north of there or south of Long Beach, where there is already offshore drilling, and go into a formation where you don't have a great deal of information going in, you have to study the reservoir and geologic formation. You have to determine whether it's even worth doing exploratory drilling. If you decide to do that as a company, you have to get permits. They can take from months to years to get. If there is opposition of any sort, then there is a very, very challenging permit process to go through to get permits just to explore for oil. If you are successful in going through all that and can drill, then you have to determine whether you find enough commercial quantity of oil to produce it in a way that makes it economically attractive and can bring the oil to market at a reasonable value. That can all take, in a place where you don't know anything at all, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years. So for those folks who have said, well, drilling now won't make a difference because it won't come to market quickly, there are some places where it will take a long time. But there are other places offshore California, as I mentioned, in the Gulf of Mexico, even in the place called Anwar in Alaska, which isn't offshore but is a pretty healthy bit of oil, 10.5 billion barrels or so, according to Randall's organization, that sits not too far away from something called the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. So there is the opportunity to bring that oil to market. Right now, we are looking at a world, according to the Energy Information Administration and other forecasters, that even with prolific growth in materials like ethanol and other biofuels, even some growth in the use of nuclear, by 2030, that organization, which is the statistical and forecasting arm of the Department of Energy, is forecasting that between oil, natural gas, and coal, we will still use 80% fossil fuels to meet the United States energy demand in 2030. So there's a reason to drill. We understand how to do it safely and with environmental sensitivity. In the 39 years since the tragic Santa Barbara spill, our industry has produced over 1 billion barrels of oil offshore California. We have spilled 850 barrels. While that's 850 barrels too much, and if you think I'm kidding, the people in this industry wake up every day and we understand what our responsibility is. We take it seriously. But that's a very, very small fraction, and I'll put it in perspective for you. There are natural seeps off the coast of California that seep approximately, according to the University of California, Santa Barbara, 55,000 barrels a year of oil from the seeps. More oil seeps in the water naturally in a week than has been spilled in the entire history of this industry offshore since the Santa Barbara spill. So just some facts around, can we bring it to shore quickly? Yes. Will it make a difference? Yes. This is a global market, and to the extent we can add to supply, we do put some pressure on price, and I think most of us in the room would agree importing 65% of every drop of oil we use every day is probably not a healthy situation for energy security. And I'll stop there.
Thanks, Joe. And my next question is for Michael Bruhn of the Rainforest Action Network. A two-part question, really. What are the short and long-term environmental risks of drilling offshore, and what are the alternatives to drilling offshore for improving our energy situation?
Okay. Thanks, Kerry. Let me make a larger point about oil dependence before I talk specifically about offshore oil drilling. A few years ago, 4.5 years ago, I was down in the Amazon, Ecuadorian Amazon, just near the Peruvian border, and I was there to visit a small village called Sarayaku that was resisting military incursion. The Ecuadorian military was about to invade to allow for oil drilling to take place on their territory. And this is in one of the most biologically diverse places on the planet. Once you get up above the canopy, you can see for miles in every direction, pristine, untouched, virgin rainforests in every direction. And we sat there for 3 days listening to testimony from person after person there who, these are folks who knew exactly who was coming into their territory, why they were coming there. They have their own website. They have satellite hookups. So they knew all of the shareholders that were involved and who was financing this operation. And what they said is, it's the 21st century now. We have rights. We don't need to, we don't want your oil, and we don't need to have our rights violated just so that we can meet a global demand for oil that seems to never end. And as I was leaving a couple days later, the chief of this community came up and she gave me a necklace for my wife because we were about to have our first child. And she said, "You have to go back to California and get to work because our community will never be free as long as your country drinks oil like it's water. We will never be free as long as you're drinking oil like it's water." I think that a lot of us, when we think about foreign oil or our domestic oil supply, we sometimes think about the burden on the U.S. economy or on U.S. foreign policy due to our dependence on foreign oil. But in reality, this woman, this chief, could have been speaking of all of us, and she could have been speaking about our domestic oil supply as well. The good news, we have to acknowledge the fact that the oil industry has brought great wealth and great convenience to our country for generations of Americans for more than 100 years. We have built our industrial society largely on the backs of the oil and coal industry, and we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude for a lot of the conveniences that we enjoy today. But I think that many of us also recognize that in the 21st century, our economy can't be based on fossil fuels. It has to be based on clean energy. Whether your concern is because of climate change, or whether your concern is about the supplies of oil and coal running out, or whether your concerns are about air pollution, water pollution, human rights, what have you. Speaking about offshore oil drilling, I look at the Bush administration. This will be the one and only time that I use the Bush administration for good data. What the Bush administration is telling us is that it will take 10 years, at least 10 years, to bring any oil to market when it's drilled offshore from new offshore drilling sites. The American Petroleum Institute says that it'll take 10 years to bring this oil to market as well. And when it does, what it will enable is more risk being borne by local taxpayers who will have to bear the risk of any oil spills that take place, and by all of us in terms of increased greenhouse gas emissions. The reality is that we could drill for more oil offshore. It would add to the global supply, but the costs of that are too high. Every dollar that we place in expanding our dependence on foreign oil or domestic oil is a dollar that is much better placed on investing in clean energy. There was a report, the last point I'll make is that there was a report by the Union of Concerned Scientists back in 2001, when the first generation of hybrids were coming onto market. And what they put forward is an analysis of the best of technologies being offered by Detroit. First-generation hybrid engines, more efficient wheel design offered in a couple different vehicles, Mazdas among them, more efficient transmissions. And what they said is that if we took the best technologies that were available in 2001, again, the first generation of hybrids, and we put them in every vehicle, we would save more oil than we import from the entire Persian Gulf. More oil than we import from the entire Persian Gulf, plus all of the oil that we get from the California continental shelf, plus all of the oil that is supposed to be up in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This was using technology that was available 7 years ago. Gandhi is famous for saying that the difference between what we do and what we're capable of doing would suffice to solve most of the world's problems. And I think that that is no more true. It couldn't be more true when we speak about meeting our future energy supplies.
Thank you, Michael. My next question is for Randall Luthi of the U.S. Government Minerals Management Service. A three-part question, and that is, how much oil is there offshore in U.S. waters? And more generally, what percentage of the world's oil is under the U.S. jurisdiction in all of the various places, onshore, offshore? And how long do we have? I mean, how long would it take to extract the oil, and how long would that last us if we had to rely exclusively on that?
Well, thank you, Carrie. And first, thank you all for coming out here tonight. I really appreciate the opportunity that you would take the time to do it. I think this is a very important topic, and it's a topic that needs to be discussed. It needs to have all points of view. We need to bring it forward. As we sat through the last, it seems like, year and a half of the election, you know, what did you hear? We need energy independence. We need energy security. We need energy reliability. Those were the words you were hearing even before we started on the economy and the problems that we've had with the economy in the last few months. It is a topic for discussion. And after the election, I can tell you that the players have changed. I'm part of the Bush administration that will only be mentioned once. But the players are changing. But the energy situation has not changed. It's my belief that the reality is we really have to do everything we can. That means take advantage of those traditional fossil fuels, that traditional forms of energy, run as fast as we can on alternative energy sources as well, and absolutely do our best to conserve more than we do. That is what we need to do. The energy situation is the same. The world economic situation is largely the same as well. You know, United States, really, we were pretty happy for a long time because we didn't need to use all of our natural domestic resources. We could always go when we needed oil and gas, particularly oil. We could always go to the world market. That is still available to us, but we're no longer just the only economy that is depending so much on oil. China, India are all growing economies. It's expected they're going to continue to grow. It's expected they're going to continue to eat and use more and more of that world supply of oil. It is going to be, in the future, it is going to be a diminishing source. The world is not a secure or reliable market for energy. I think we should look at home to develop our energy resources. Domestic oil and gas production can play a part of that. I enjoy talking about what it should be in the future, and I agree. We need to go more towards alternative forms of energy. But the reality is, as far as we can tell, and I appreciate Joe using some of the statistics, the Energy Information Administration, again, predicts by 2030, 80% of our energy source will be coal, oil, and gas. Now, that can change. That can change through the efforts of you and us conserving. It can change through the efforts of changing to alternative fuels. But if we double the amount of renewables, which most people say is unlikely or able to do, but even if we did, that would still mean we're looking at probably 60% of our energy to come from coal, oil, and gas. It just makes more sense to me that we should be able to develop it at home. That's going to be a much secure source, and certainly the Middle East. In fact, our biggest trade, our biggest partner in energy supply is actually Canada. And Mexico, we've relied on for many years as well as a supply of oil. But you'll see that they have continued to decrease in production as technology in their fields begin to be questionable as well. You asked how much oil is out there. I think the range is whatever anybody wants almost. Joe mentioned 10.5 billion barrels off the coast of California. We think that's a pretty good estimate. But let me give you an example of the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico, the United States and companies have been drilling there actively for years, absolute years. Well, back in the early 80s, we suspect that there was probably about 9 billion barrels potential. The more they looked, they found. And that's one of the interesting things about oil and gas is you don't find it unless you look for it. But what we do find out is when you find it, you often find more than what you thought was there. Or the technology changes where you're able to get at deeper and deeper resources. Gulf of Mexico is a good example. They now drill in 10,000 feet of water. We'll go down several thousand feet below that. They're finding new resources. They're finding new oil. Well, we now estimate, back in the 80s of 9, we now think it's more like 54, 55. In terms of the United States as a whole, if you looked at the lower 48, the lower continental 48, for the last 20 years, nearly all of the West Coast and all of the East Coast has been forbidden from looking for oil and gas for exploration activities. Over 20 years, it's been that way. We don't know for sure what is there, particularly on the East Coast. Now, last summer, President Bush lifted the executive withdrawal, and then in the fall, early fall, October 1, Congress allowed the moratorium on both the coasts to expire. So technically, those are open for development now. The reality is it will be a long time before those areas are developed. And one of the reasons is there is no structure, no infrastructure to get the oil from where it might be to the shore. So when we talk about estimates of 10 years, I can see that as being reasonable. But I can also see a much shorter period of time, particularly in California, if you happen to drill right next to where you already have an existing structure. That's going to be a lot shorter period of time. And I would take Joe's word that 2-3 years. That's the best. I couldn't do any better on a guess for that. Another area we have is the eastern Gulf of Mexico that is still currently under moratorium. Again, that is an area that's near existing facilities, near existing infrastructure. Should that be opened, the possibility exists that that could be a reliable source of energy in the near future. I know you wanted us to keep our opening remarks relatively short, but I am a politician. But I'd just like to mention again on the Gulf of Mexico, we talk about safety. Can we do it safely? If you talk about the entire outer continental shelf, since about 1971, approximately 30 years, about 13,000 exploratory wells have been drilled, about 13,000. Of those exploratory wells, we've had 4 spills. That's a pretty good record, and it's getting better all the time. The Gulf of Mexico, one of the things that concerns me is we have all those energy eggs in that basket, and you've seen what hurricanes do when they come through. Ike Gustav shut down the oil and gas production, 100% was shut in during those storms. Over 50 platforms were destroyed, yet we don't have any reports of significant oiling to the resources onshore from outer continental shelf activities. There were some spills, but the safety valves worked, the check valves worked. It can be done. You'll never eliminate all the risk. You will never eliminate all the risk, but we think we can make it as minimal as possible. Thanks, Kerry.
Thank you, Randall. Next question is for Peter Schwartz, who is with was the founder of the Global Business Network. A two-part question, Peter. What kind of future does oil have in the 21st century energy market? And do you believe that offshore drilling provides any strategic advantage for the United States?
Well, first of all, thanks to the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event and do very good work, and I'm very pleased to be part of it. With respect to oil in the long run, the world has plenty of oil, but the world uses lots of oil. And the amount of oil in the world is a function of price and technology. As the price goes up, we can find oil that was deep offshore or in far away and difficult places. And secondly, as technology improves, we're able to get at some of that oil that we couldn't before. So the supply of oil in at least the next half century is not a fundamental issue. In the long run, beyond that, it probably is. And as the oil minister of Saudi Arabia said in the 1970s, Sheikh Yamani, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stone. It's because the technology changed. The Bronze Age and the Iron Age began. And we are beginning to change our technology, not because we're running out of oil, but because of climate change and environmental considerations, most of all. And I believe that climate change, more than anything else, will shape the future of oil. I believe climate change is an extremely urgent issue. I'm perhaps even more radical than Al Gore on this, though I don't believe his answer is unfortunately realistic. But having said that, I've been involved in climate change studies since the mid-1970s when I was at SRI. And the climate of the Earth is changing, and it's changing far more rapidly than most people believe. And global warming is a misnomer. That conjures up an image that perhaps someday Portland will have the climate of San Diego. Well, wrong. That's not the right image. The right image is that the world will have an increasing frequency of extreme events in more places. Think the recent typhoon that hit Myanmar, the drought in Australia, the mega monsoon that hit Bangladesh, Hurricane Katrina. None of these can actually be attributed to climate change as such, but they are typical of the events that will become ever more common in more places around the world. The urgency of this is profound. When 160 million Bangladeshis have to leave home without an American Express card because their whole entire country is flooded and the only place to go is China or India, we're going to have a hell of a problem on our hands. So the issue here is climate change that will drive the need to radically reduce the amount of oil. So The issue for us is actually reducing the amount of oil, not, I believe, because of energy independence or security, because I believe that's a fantasy. I also share the view of the other members of the panel in terms of the ability to drill and produce oil offshore safely and environmentally responsibly. The industry has done a very good job in recent decades of improving and constantly getting better at that. It is not entirely without risk, but if you look at the history for the last 30 years since the early 1970s, it's a very good history. So the risks are actually quite low. However, let us suppose that we actually did it, and I suspect we will do some. What difference would it make? And the answer is not very much. That's the problem, is that it is not going to change fundamentally the U.S.'s strategic position. The U.S. is in fundamental decline with respect to the production of oil. We will slow the rate of decline a bit over some periods of time, but we will not change fundamentally the trajectory. The trajectory is driven by demand, and that is mostly about transportation. It's mostly about cars and buses and trucks. It's about how all of you got here tonight. Until we are willing to give up our cars or radically reduce the consumption that our cars have by driving either smaller cars or new kinds of cars, e.g. hybrid vehicles, we are not going to change the circumstances fundamentally. No supply solution will change that situation fundamentally. And as was observed, most of the supply we deal with comes from Canada, Mexico, our good friends in Venezuela, who own a number of service stations here in the United States and would like to supply those, or our good friends in Saudi Arabia, who also own service stations here and would like to supply them. So the real issue is not about additional supplies. We should probably do that for a different reason than we've argued. And unfortunately, the alternative energy sources that we talk about, whether solar or wind, aren't a substitute for gasoline. Until we figure out really good electric vehicles and the ability to produce baseload electricity with renewables or much better biofuels, we are going to be using gasoline for a long time to power our cars. Now, eventually, we may be able to produce it biologically through synthetic biology or the like, but that's some time off. So unfortunately, we're stuck with gasoline for quite a long time, and we're stuck, therefore, with oil imports for quite a long time. We can reduce it somewhat. If the United States had, as it had the option in the 1980s, to increase its mileage to, say, 35 miles per gallon, which is what we ought to have done at the time, and Ronald Reagan stopped, but if we had done that, today our oil imports would be 3 or 4 million barrels a day and mostly come from our neighbors. That takes decades to make that transition. We haven't begun that transition. The Congress has not raised the standards nearly far enough, and so we will not see that 35 mile per gallon until another decade or so hence. So having said that, it means we're going to use more oil, which means we're going to import more oil even if we increase offshore production. The argument for offshore production, however, actually relates to a different argument associated with Michael Brun's story about Ecuador. And that is, it is immoral not to increase oil production as long as we suck other people's oil in beautiful places like the rainforests, as long as we ask them to bear the costs and say we would like to have our environment pristine, then we have no moral foundation for our position. I've been in the deserts of Saudi Arabia. They're beautiful. They're magnificent. They're pristine, except where the oil is produced. Now, they're pretty good at it. They don't make too big a mess. They like their deserts, and they're good about what they deal with as well. And most oil companies in much of the world, though not all of the world, prefer to do their job right and do it professionally, not everywhere. Visit some parts of Nigeria, visits lots of places in Russia, other parts of the world. They aren't so neat and as our companies tend to be. But having said that, the real argument is to ask them to bear the environmental cost that we will not bear is fundamentally wrong. It's just like asking to put LNG terminals in Mexico rather than in the United States and then using the gas from those LNG terminals, because it's all right for Mexicans to bear the risk, but not Americans. Americans need to recognize that we consume and create consequences for our consumption around the world. And if we don't want to bear those costs at home, then we have no moral position for saying that we should stop our own consumption and stop our own production here abroad, here at home, as long as we are willing to despoil other people's environment abroad. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. That's a wonderful point. You've got a lot of nerve bringing morality into this. I have a follow-up question for Michael. It has to do with the 10-year time frame. So let's say in the 10-year time frame that it'll take to bring oil from new places offshore as opposed to existing areas, what could we do with alternative sources of energy developing new sources in that 10 years, renewable sources and other sources, that in lieu of drilling for more oil?
Well, there's a lot that we can do in 10 years, and I'll disagree with Peter a little bit on this to start by saying that if China can do it, why can't the United States? If China can hit a set a standard for fuel efficiency of 35 miles per gallon, which is where it's at today, why can't the United States?
We should.
Let me just finish. The United States signed a bill last year, which will commit the country to increase our fuel efficiency by 1 mile per gallon per year, roughly, between now and 2020. At which point we'll, by 2020, achieve the standard that China has established today. What we know is that hybrid cars work. They work quite well. I drive a Prius. We get about 45 to 50 miles per gallon. These are technologies that are available today across a small range of vehicles. We also know that plug-in hybrid vehicles will be coming onto market soon, and they will work well. The challenge, I think, I'm much more optimistic in terms of the technology that we have than perhaps some of the other panelists tonight. The challenge that we have is to not simply have a few token vehicles, a few hybrid vehicles that we can sell to all the consumers in Berkeley and Boulder and Ann Arbor and Madison, Wisconsin, all the people who shop at Whole Foods and who buy certified wood and who are members of Rainforest Action Network. Thank you very much. But to mass-produce vehicles. And as long as we can produce clean, fuel-efficient vehicles, every vehicle should be clean and fuel-efficient. What I think is possible within 10 years is that we can electrify transportation. The typical manufacturing time frame to introduce new vehicles is 3 to 5 years, depending on the urgency in Detroit. So within 3 to 5 years, we can have increasing percentages, 25, then 50, then 100% of our vehicles running on being manufactured as hybrid and then plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. So we electrify transportation, and then we green the grid. In terms of producing electricity more cleanly, the potential here is enormous. There are 25 states around the country now that have signed renewable portfolio standards, committing each state to produce 25, sometimes up to 30% of their electricity from clean and renewable energy sources. In 2007, we added 3 times more new wind capacity than we added new coal capacity. Here in California, we installed more solar panels in the first 9 months of 2007 than were installed in the last 26 years combined. So the growth of the solar and wind industries is enormous, and they can take on an increasing share of the burden, which can enable us to reduce our dependence on oil. Once we electrify transportation, then we can green the grid.
Can I respond to that?
Thank you, Michael. And I think Randall had some response to that as well as Peter. So let's go with Peter first.
Peter was so excited, I'll let him go first.
Well, yeah, first of all, I think that is where we're going. We will essentially, within a reasonable period of time, the only question is how fast, virtually every new vehicle, ground transportation vehicle, will have electric drive. And I think plug-in hybrid is the right answer. The only question is how fast. And unfortunately, I mean, we have some indication historically. I worked with the Brown administration in the 1970s on efficiency standards for everything like appliances, et cetera. And the average Californian today consumes 30% less electricity than the rest of the country. But it took 3 decades for that to happen. And unfortunately, we have the reality. Look, you take the hybrid. Okay, so my wife was feeling guilty in the carpool because she had a BMW and the other two ladies had a Prius. Okay, fine. She said, I need a hybrid too. What did she do? She went and bought a Lexus 400H, great big hybrid, that got a little worse mileage than her BMW X3 because it's heavier and a big box. Most of the gain actually in your Prius is aerodynamics. It's 70% aerodynamics, not the motor. I'm an aeronautical engineer, and I like that. It's a very slippery car. Lexus is not. So the point is, what happens when we get a lot of these efficiency gains is people take them as amenity. So we have bigger refrigerators today, even if per cubic meter we are actually consuming less. And that's the issue, is that the challenge of change takes a long time, and the cumulative effects are going to take decades. That's the problem and why we will need that gasoline for a long time. My wife feels good because it says hybrid on the side. She has not saved a drop of gasoline.
She's not here to defend herself, let the record show. Randall, you had something to say.
Well, I was just going to add, Peter does such a great job of doing that. But again, some of it comes back to cost and what you can perform or what you can actually afford to do as an average American wage earner. I noticed when I came in today from the airport, as you always do, there's a lot of traffic around here. You know, I'm originally from Wyoming. I probably saw more cars today than I even knew existed for most of my life.
More than in your state,
actually. Absolutely, yeah. More people and in the state. So it is. It's a culture change as well. I look as coal, oil, and gas. And frankly, I'm somewhat parochial. Wyoming is an energy-producing state, and we produce a lot of coal. We produce some oil and quite a bit of gas. I mean, so that's what my background is. That's what my history is. I understand it. But it doesn't mean I don't think we should keep striving to move forward. One of the things I'm very proud of at the Minerals Management Service is a couple of years ago, Congress gave us the authority to put alternative energy, regulate alternative energy on the outer continental shelf. The ideas of wind farms, current, wave, energy is something now that we have that we as an agency have been given the ability to regulate. And I'll tell you, it's absolutely exciting to hear what's there. Now, what is also interesting is those are not without environmental impacts. Wind farms, the footprint they take is much larger in reality than an oil well is. We have there's a company trying to put a wind farm off the coast of Massachusetts right now. It's called Cape Wind. And it is just fascinating to hear the arguments against it and for it. I mean, we will eventually have to make a decision on that project, but it's just fascinating to hear the pros and cons for that. It's different, it's new, it's a possibility. I think we should be heading that way. Oil and gas should, and I won't say that's what's going to happen, but it should be a bridge to the future. But we need it, or else I'm afraid we're going to be walking to that future.
Joe Sperano had a response.
Yeah, and it's not so much a response as an observation. I think the insights from the other three panelists have been great, and I don't think you hear a gross difference about the need to have more forms of energy. And I'll let you in on an industry secret. Our members are very well invested in things like wind farms and solar panels, and even one of our biggest members has developed a thin film that will allow the plug-in electric hybrids, the better, bigger lithium-ion batteries to function in a car without burning up the rest of the engine. It's an oil company did that, their chemical arm. It's ExxonMobil. And that's going to work, and it's going to be great. We cannot afford to be so smug as to think we don't need to use every form of energy that's available. And that means oil and gas and nuclear and coal and make it cleaner burning and ethanol and biodiesel and electric cars and convert coal to gas and liquid, convert gas to clean burning liquid. We can't afford to not use all the forms of energy that are available to us, and each form becomes more attractive as technology gets better and as the cost to produce those forms of energy go down. Cost is a big issue. We have a society right now struggling a great deal with economic damage, and we're going to need to keep that in mind as we go forward. But I think if all of us can embrace the ideal that we need to produce all the forms of energy that we can safely and smartly and with environmental sensitivity, we're going to be a lot further along than we are today.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight, we're talking with a panel of experts about both the short-term and the long-term advantages and disadvantages of offshore oil drilling. Our panelists are Joe Sperano, president of the Western States Petroleum Association, Michael Bruhn, executive director of the Rainforest Action Network, Randall Luthi, director of the U.S. Minerals Management Service, and Peter Schwartz, co-founder and chairman of the Global Business Network. Now, we have many really good questions from the audience, so I need to get started on those. One of the questions, I'll just read this one word for word. What percentage of oil revenues from California offshore drilling would come to the state of California?
And that would probably be my that falls in my rubric to answer. Currently, there's one way to share revenues on offshore resources, and that comes under the authority of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. And what it provides, most states have state submerged lands up to so many miles off the shore. California is 3. Most of the states are 3 miles. Now, then the federal government takes over in terms of leasing. All that leasing, all that control within 3 miles of the coastline is done by the state of California. Now, right now, under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, if there are any leases, federal leases, that are purchased along that 3 mile line, that's revenue sharing. That's about 37.5% of what the government takes in would go to the state of California. Now, we'll use it one more time. The Bush administration would like to see that changed. They would like to say that there would be a revenue sharing with states anywhere in the Outer Continental Shelf. But that's going to have to take a change by Congress, some kind of an actual change. The Gulf of Mexico does allow more revenue sharing. It was under what they call the Gulf Gomesa Act, the Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act, which allows 27.5% of revenues to be shared with the state. And it can be substantial. We had a sale in the Gulf of Mexico last year that brought in $3.6 billion in bonus bids. That's just the first stage. That gives the company the right to go out and look. If there's production, then 18.75% royalty is collected after production starts. So it could be substantial. You can't say that it is until there's a law change. You can't say that it would be till there's actual production. But there is potential.
Thank you, Randall. I'd like to get back to the question of the environmental safety. The message I'm getting is that oil spills are much less frequent than they used to be and are reasonably under control. If that's not true, feel free to speak up. But is that the only source of environmental threat from offshore drilling? When you drill an oil well in offshore, even if you don't spill a drop, does that increase the amount of seepage? Are there other environmental impacts? That's one question. Another audience member says, can drilling leases be structured in the spirit of environmental mitigation to compel energy companies to build rigs and artificial reefs that enhance fisheries and recreation? So that's kind of a two-part question, and I see Joe's primed. Joe Sperano's
Let me take a shot at some of that, because it's a great question. And when you drill a well now, there are mitigation measures that you have to commit to as part of the permitting process to mitigate your emissions. I find the question about reefs fascinating. When people decommission a rig, there's a notion, and supported by science, that those rigs are tremendous hatcheries for fish life. There is a great an abundance of fish life around the rigs. They are natural reefs, and there's a program called Rigs to Reefs for those that are to be decommissioned. Rather than pulling them out of the water, cut them off at the water line or some safe distance for shipping, and allow the fish life to grow and prosper. There is, I think, an opportunity there for that to be a good thing rather than a bad thing. The third thing I want to mention, and I'll turn it over to the other panelists, is the issue of seepage, and I brought it up initially, that 55,000 barrels a year of oil currently seeps offshore California into the natural marine environment. There has been a study for 22 years at the University of California, Santa Barbara, that has shown that over that period, with drilling in state water in particular, that the pressure has been relieved on the formation such that the seepage has been in a downtrend in terms of the volume of oil that's come up from the shore. So there is a group of folks, and not everybody agrees with this, so I don't want to act smug about it, but there are a lot of people and some scientific evidence that shows that this natural seepage is reduced by drilling in the same area.
Thank you, Joe. I think Michael Bruhn of the Rainforest Action Network had a comment.
Yeah, I'd like to just speak to the environmental impacts of the oil industry, and in particular drilling. I do think that we ought to restrain our enthusiasm regarding the idea that the oil industry is cleaning up its environmental impacts, particularly in the Gulf. Hurricane Ike just a couple months ago resulted in the spillage of 500,000 barrels of oil, which I do think is actually quite significant. The process of drilling for oil creates the release of arsenic and benzene and other cancer-causing chemicals. The oil industry is a toxic industry from extraction to combustion. And although it may be true in certain areas that the amount of air pollution and water pollution is declining, it doesn't mean that they're not significant, because they are highly significant. Once the oil is extracted and transported, when it's refined, more than five dozen different cancer-causing chemicals are produced. 90 million Americans live within the pollution zone around America's refineries. So our dependence on oil isn't just something that relates to offshore oil drilling. Throughout the entire process, our dependence on oil results in significant amounts of air and water pollutants. And then I do need to add one final note about climate change. Oil is one of the world's largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions, and we will not be able to fight climate change as long as we're focusing on how to access increased amounts of oil. You know, if the country is addicted to oil, we have to start figuring out how to break our addiction, not where we're going to get our next fix.
Last week on Friday, we had a program at the Commonwealth Club observing the first anniversary of the Costco Busan oil spill in the bay. And I was shocked, amazed at how, when I learned that the volunteers that wanted to leap in and start helping to clean that up couldn't be allowed to do that, because the oil itself was so hazardous that you're at risk to even touch it. So I think that corroborated the point that oil has a certain degree of hazard associated with it, even if you're not actually spilling it as you're drilling it. Joe, I saw you were making a bit of a face when Michael was talking about the oil spilled in the Gulf of Mexico.
Did my New Jersey roots betray me, perhaps?
Yes, they did.
In defense of New Jersey, I'm from exit 82, by the way.
Exit 82?
Yeah.
There isn't an exit.
That's Garden Park.
On the
Parkway.
Parkway.
The Garden
State
Parkway.
Okay.
Parkway,
yeah. Hey, that's great. We have a lot in common.
This is the New Jersey reunion.
Exit 4.
Right. There's a guy from Wyoming, but we're kind of ignoring him. No, the thing I wanted to say was I think that, you can talk about the figures of oil that may or may not have been spilled, and I think Randall has an opportunity to clarify what those numbers really are. It's regrettable when any drop spills. It's not what we're about. Keeping oil out of the water is what we live to do every day. The amount of oil that's been spilled through 4 horrific hurricanes and the amount that has reached shore, which I believe is almost none, I think is indicative of a point that Randall brought up earlier, the technology to keep that oil cut off at the seabed floor so that when a pipe is broken or a rig is pulled from its moorings, you don't get this tremendous rush of oil. So I just wanted to clarify that point rather than making a funny face.
May I just add one small point? And that is, look, the oceans are at risk. We've got huge issue with the oceans. And I find it troubling that we're focusing on this issue, which I think is, in terms of our political will and energy, agricultural runoff, sewage from all over the world, the dead zones from the phosphates. There's all kinds of stuff affecting our oceans that are really dreadful and huge problems. This is not one of them. And so it feels to me an enormous amount of political energy going into something that, by and large, is relatively inconsequential when given the huge issues we actually do face, both in climate change and the destruction of the oceans.
Yeah, and I wanted to follow that up. Another fallout of the political wrangling about offshore drilling is that if we finally reach the consensus as a country that we're gonna drill, baby, drill, I worry that it's going to take some of the steam out of the political will that we have as a country to make the investments that we need to make in alternative sources of energy. Anybody have a comment about that?
I would, and I'm probably the one that's probably least likely, to have a comment about it. I don't think it will. I will hope that last summer's experience of, record high prices woke us up, actually gave us that call we've been needing to say how little control we have in a global economy of what often happens of our energy prices. We can do more to stabilize those prices by increasing domestic energy production. We can, we should, we will. However, we know that that is not the long-term solution. Use it as a bridge. Use it to get to where we want to be. That would be my hope and philosophy as a country goes forward.
I really don't think we're going to increase our domestic or affect our prices much, I must say, in a world where most of the marginal oil is high-cost oil. And so bringing price of oil back down is, I think, not a reasonable objective in any meaningful sense. It's controlled by the market price in the world, and we're not going to save much money by increasing our supply.
And certainly the market reliability can be increased.
Well, I think that generating the political will that's necessary to transform the way in which oil is consumed, to transform the way in which we transport ourselves and how cars are produced and vehicles and whatnot, of course, is an immense challenge. We've had every president since Nixon has talked about ending our dependence on foreign oil, and every Congress has also talked about reducing our dependence on oil generally. Every president has failed, Democrat, Republican. Every Congress has failed. Our dependence on foreign oil and our consumption of oil overall has grown significantly. However, I do think that it can be done, and I'm very hopeful that with a new administration and a new Congress and motivated by recently high gas prices and the threat of climate change, that we can transform the way in which cars are produced in the country today. Back in World War II, President Roosevelt showed immense leadership in shutting down the American auto fleet in order to transform American manufacturing capacity into a wartime manufacturing zone, in which we were able to defeat fascism in Europe primarily through the might of the American manufacturing ability. Right now, we do have the ability to We have the technology, we have the resources to significantly reduce our dependence on oil. What we need, what we lack, what we desperately need is more political will. The best way to tell the future is to look at how our country, what investments in infrastructure our country is making. If we are investing in more oil drilling offshore or in other regimes or in hard to get places, we will have we will be wedded to the oil industry for years to come. If we invest today, if every dollar we're putting in today is for clean energy and for more efficient transportation, in 5 years, in 10 years, that's the industries that will grow and that's the industries that will flourish. I think that we, you know, if climate change is a high-risk game of poker that we're playing, it's time to go all in for clean energy.
And I appreciate that, but let's talk about the investment. Are you talking about a government investment of taxpayers' money, or are you talking about a political investment? That's the other thing we need to talk about. Let me give the example of Brazil. The oil embargo of 1973 crippled and hurt that nation tremendously. At that time, they were a military regime. They were able to make changes much faster and certainly in what we would consider a very undemocratic manner. They are now... I mean, we do. You use the term energy independent somewhat, you know, carefully, and I want to use it carefully. But they are pretty much energy independent now because they started huge investments of their of the country's financial resources and tax breaks for a long period of time into biofuels, sugarcane. But it's taken them over 30 years. But they also developed their offshore oil program, which is interesting. They have become an exporter of oil now and are benefiting from the world's reliance upon oil. So it is possible, without a doubt. Again, it's in. And right now we have an oil industry that's mature enough that doesn't necessarily... We might can help them on royalty rates, on deep wells, if the prices are not, you know, high. That's one way we can encourage investment. But I think we should do it all. It just comes back to do it all, do it now, do it safely.
Let me add just a quick comment now that my microphone works. We need to be careful. The cost is one issue. Whatever we transist to, wherever we get as a society with a wide variety of energy sources, we need to be careful that as we put new sources on a pedestal that we do the scientific examination that's necessary to ensure that in their full life cycle, some of the new fuels are in fact cleaner than the fuels they're going to replace. It's really important that that job be done scientifically and carefully, and there's evidence out there that it isn't quite so clear what might be cleaner, what form of energy might be cleaner than another. But what's absolutely certain is that we need to work with all of the forms of energy in order to get through the next few years.
I'd like to address an audience question here to Peter. How much oil consumption would be saved if we convert to nuclear power sources?
Well, this goes back to, I think, Michael's earlier comment. For nuclear power to provide an alternative oil, it means you have to electrify the vehicles. And I think that is where we're going. Eventually, basically, I think every ground transportation will have electric motors that turn the wheels. The interesting question is, where does the electricity come from? And as Michael suggested, in the near future, a lot of it will be coming from hybrid vehicles, some from plug-in hybrid vehicles. We'll see a variety of different technologies competing in the marketplace over the next decade or two. Eventually, our batteries hopefully will get good enough that it'll be dominantly battery vehicles, and we will provide electricity to them from the grid. But right now, the batteries aren't really very good. Unfortunately, I am a director of a microfuel cell company that is 7 years into its four-year R&D program. And we are running on less than fumes at the moment. And that is typical of the venture capital startup industry, of which I'm a part of and investing in. I'm an investor in one of the major battery startups. Also, and it's the one that is going to go into the car that GM is going to make. Well, it's a pretty good battery, but it's only a pretty good battery. And so the first question is, when do we get to good batteries? Hopefully in the next decade we will. If we do that, then we have interesting questions about producing electricity. And then the question is, what's the full range of technologies for electricity? And I believe it is, in fact, nuclear power. solar and wind, hopefully clean coal, and I say hopefully because we don't yet have the technology for really cleaning up coal from a CO2 perspective. For quite a long time, it'll be natural gas. In the U.S., today, nuclear power provides about a quarter to a third of electricity, depending on how you count it. We might be able to increase that by another 20% or so and get it up to 40% if we're lucky. That would require a near heroic effort constructing. So we're still going to need all this other stuff anyway. So at most, nukes could probably provide something on the order of 30 to 40% of our transport, at most.
Okay. I think Michael has a response.
Let's hope not. Nuclear power right now produces 20% of our electricity. If we were to increase it to 30, 40%, it would be one of the biggest inefficient ways to spend taxpayer money as well as private money. Nuclear power right now is the most expensive form of energy because it cannot survive without federal loan guarantees, federal insurance guarantees, and federal subsidies. From an economics perspective, it would be one of the least wise investments that we could make. From a energy security and safety perspective, a national security perspective, building a large fleet of nuclear power plants in an age of terrorism, when we haven't been able to fully secure our current supply of nuclear waste, I think is a foolish notion. What I do think, where Peter and I do agree, of course, is that transportation will become increasingly electrified. And the growth rate in solar and wind and geothermal is already beginning to absorb most of the increase in our electricity demand. What we've seen, however, in the last 18 months is the growth of massive solar farms here in the desert, in California and the desert southwest, the Saudi Arabia of sun, and massive growth in wind farms in Texas and throughout the Midwest. These facilities are large enough that many of them are approaching the size of a typical nuclear power plant or of a typical coal-fired power plant. So soon we'll be in the position where not only can we absorb the growth in our energy demand over time through renewables, but we'll be able to start shutting down coal plants and shutting down nuclear plants, retiring them and replacing them with clean energy.
You're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, a panel discussion about offshore oil drilling. And now we've reached the point in our program where we have time for just one more question for each of our panelists, and it has to do with the new Obama administration. So if you were each of you individually were hired as an advisor to the Obama administration about energy, what would you urge his administration to do in the first year or so about energy, including oil and all of the other things that we've talked about? I'll start on my left with Michael Brun.
I'll highlight three things. First, to enact federally binding climate change legislation that puts a cap on carbon emissions, that puts a price on carbon, so we can put a value on the pollution that we're causing that we're emitting constantly. Second thing would be to put significant investments, federal investments, in these large-scale solar and wind facilities that I was just talking about, as well as a smart grid, which will enable the efficient transmission of that power from the area where it's being generated, primarily in the Southwest and primarily in the Midwest in terms of wind, to the areas in which it would be consumed. And the third thing that I would do would be to is what he's doing right now, or what he's talking about doing right now, which is to see this moment of crisis in Detroit and to utilize this call for help from federal taxpayers as an enormous and historic opportunity to invest in Detroit and invest in our automobile industry and spur a radical increase in fuel efficiency that is a condition of the proposed bailout.
Thank you, Michael. Randall Luthi.
Thank you. And I smile because I know that there is just no way that the Obama administration will be interested in the old Bush administration. But I would say two things. One, don't reverse what was done in the last year. Let's keep the option open for drilling on the Outer Continental Shelf. Keep that plan moving forward. Keep it as an option. It'll pay off in the big time. Second, in the future, and I think it will pay off big time. Second thing I'd remind is that when we talk about federal investments, the federal government doesn't make money. Well, we do make money. We don't earn money. It's taxpayers' money. That's what it is. Be mindful of that. When we talk about federal investments, it's always the taxpayer that puts that in. Thank you.
So, you know, I think we know what to do. In fact, I agree with almost everything that Michael has said, except nuclear power, which I'm in favor of. The reality, unfortunately, is that the policy of the last every administration, really since the 1960s, has been maximize demand, minimize supply, and buy the rest from the people that hate us the most. And we have a political gridlock. And so the real challenge, I think, of the Obama administration is breaking the gridlock. There are too many people who win from the current system and others who perceive they will lose from any major transformation, whether it's labor in Detroit or environmentalists in California. What he needs to do is find the political formula that enables a balance of those interests, both in geography and time. There are things that we will do today that we will have to deal with later and other things that we will have to deal with in the future. So we need a balance over space and time of all those interests in order to break the political gridlock that we have, because otherwise he will have no greater success than every president before him.
Thanks, Peter. And Joe Sperano, you get the last word.
I want you all to know that I've been invited by the Obama administration to be their new Secretary of Energy. Yeah. And as a result, I have a plan that will be initiated in about a week. Actually, a week after January 20th. To be serious, I think the president has a great opportunity, and depoliticizing the debate and the decision-making and policy-making around energy supply and energy conservation is perhaps the best thing that he could possibly do, and I don't know how he will do it. If I did, maybe I'd be there. But the president has a tremendous challenge in that regard. Three things. I think looking at creating a national program to address climate change, one that which states that are already doing it can harmonize their programs with and have a national effort that includes market mechanisms. Also encourage and support greater greater access to domestic supplies, whatever they may be, and ensure that they're produced cleanly. And finally, to keep in mind that none of these activities is free, and that the worst thing we could do is to create an environment where costs go up, consumers suffer pain, and our economy ends up in a worse place. And so I think attention to that detail will be very important, and I wish him the best in doing it.
Thanks. Please join me in thanking our panel. You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club on the subject of offshore oil drilling. Our panelists have been Joe Sperano, president of the Western States Petroleum Association; Michael Brune, Executive Director of Rainforest Action Network; Randall Luthy, Director of the U.S. Minerals Management Service; and Peter Schwartz, Co-Founder and Chairman of the Global Business Network. And now, with that, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, observing over a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.